that?
Welcome to Afoot, a podcast about mysteries, all kinds of mysteries. And I'll start with answering one mystery. I'm your host, Glenn Fleischman. And each episode, I'm gathering people from a set of panelists, people who have foolhardily volunteered to talk about secrets and crime, police procedurals, and racetrack mysteries. And joining me this week are four guests who are a part of this routine approach. And let me introduce them each in turn. So with mystery maybe broached. Farthest away, Shannon Sutter, thank you for joining us from North Carolina.
Hello.
This will all become clear in a moment. Thank you. Katie Lane from the great state of Oregon from PDX. Hi, Katie.
Junior detective reporting for duty.
Also, strangely, from Portland, Gene McDonald. Gene, how's it going?
It's going very well.
And the Portland adjacent, James Callan. James, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, just like Spokane is the serial murder capital of the world, what is Portland the capital of? Usually creativity, but perhaps there's a locus of mystery there, too. This topic, our episode, is devoted to the running title is Make Mine Marple, which was suggested by Jean McDonald, and thus appropriate she's on this episode, because she has a lot to say about this. And the idea is to talk about something that I think it's not unique to mystery as a genre necessarily, but it has a unique aspect that women are routinely not just writers, and often many of the most well-known writers of mysteries are women, but also the protagonists in many series are women. And, you know, it's hard to find genres in literature in which it's that common without the genre having become some kind of, you know, exiled ghetto. Like romance is looked down upon, justly or unjustly, but it is. And it's, you know, a woman's genre and chick lit and so forth. It's like this is mystery is one of the more encompassing ones. It's not to say that women writers have an easy time of it at all, because in any field of endeavor, there's always issues. But it's a very different thing than, say, science fiction. Historically, even though there were prominent women in science fiction, fantasy was always a genre that women were often, you know, pushed into. But mystery hasn't had that. And I was going to give a little history, a little research for this, because, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, we talked about in our first episode, and it's well known, he's considered the father of detective fiction, having kind of invented the idea of a detective, first of all, a detective, when the term didn't even exist as such, and a thinker, someone who saw false clues and disregarded them, spotted things that are obvious to us later, bumbling police officers, grotesque murders, a sidekick. Well, that's Edgar Allan Poe. But Anna Katharine Green, who I don't think has gotten quite the due, she's considered the mother. And she wrote her first mystery in 1878, which is decades after Poe, but the genre still had not really picked up steam. And I found Wikipedia has a great little summary, as it often does. She's the one who created elderly spinster and young female sleuths. She added dead bodies in libraries, newspaper clippings as clues, coroner's inquest, expert witnesses. She wrote dozens of mysteries until her death in the 1930s, invented Amelia Butterworth, an old maid of good family, an uncertain age, who knew who did it, apparently, but didn't necessarily disclose it to anybody, which I think is fun. Mystery was a genre that women wrote for extensively in the 1890s and into the 1910s, apparently. Even since then, it never sort of became the province of men, and women fought back for a role in. It's actually, you look at the founding members of the Mystery Writers of America, there's all guys, but you look at the awards that were granted, and Agatha Christie was the first recipient of an award by that association. And then over time, even though, of course, it was dominated by men for a while, it moves rather rapidly into awards and other distinctions being given relatively equally among genders. So, you know, that's just a little bit of the background, and I think it's a great field to talk about, because, you know, often we're not hunting for examples here. We're not trying to, or even trying to reclaim history. It's more like this is something that's very common, and it's so unusual. I want to talk about it because so many of my favorite, both mystery writers and mystery protagonists, are female. So I think we should open up the floor now that I've bored people with some history. Those don't know. Read Wikipedia for more information. But no, we'll put some in the show notes. Things like there's Wikipedia does have a great entry, which is every female protagonist in mysteries. It's an extraordinary list. It's very, very long. So, Gene, this was your topic idea, and I loved it. And I know, among other things, you've been annotating bibliography about books. What's your take on the role of, you know, talk about the role of women in general in mystery from the writer or protagonist standpoint, you know, written, movies, video games, whatever. And also, you know, who drives you there? Like, what are your favorites that you come back to?
You know, I think one of the things that's interesting about this genre and, you know, to, you know, disclaim from the beginning, like, I'm not really a fan of Miss Marple, or I'm definitely hard-boiled versus cozy. I'm firmly in the hard-boiled camp. So essentially not the whodunit, the genteel whodunit of a Miss Marple, but more the gritty, rough and tumble and violence of a detective story.
We established in episode number one, you want a body.
I want a body. Yes, I was thinking about this. One of the things that I think is really interesting about at least the detective novels that I like, so where the main character, the protagonist, is actually a detective or a private investigator. So somebody who's makes their living, you know, detecting, as opposed to being a journalist or a teacher or a gardener or whatever that happens to be good at solving mysteries, or, you know, a Miss Marple, a spinster. What I think is really interesting is that, like, most of the great detectives in this genre are really messed up personal life-wise. You know, they are almost always divorced, alcoholic, curmudgeonly, and the women in the genre have the same exact problems. So when I think about, you know, some of the original very popular women detectives, like, you know, the Kinsey Millhone in Sue Grafton's series, she's divorced twice. She's not an alcoholic, but she is addicted to quarter pounders with cheese, which is really weird. And I'm always afraid when I read a new one, I'm like, this is going to make me want to go to McDonald's. I really don't want to go to McDonald's. but she doesn't do well with people. And I think that, you know, there's not a lot of happy detectives. You know, I mean, we'll definitely have lots of exceptions to this rule. But to me, I think it's interesting that a lot of the original writers in this genre, not original, you know, going back as far as you were talking about, but the ones who created the women detectives of the 70s and 80s, who were basically emancipated women who did what they wanted to, and they lived on their own, and they had the relationships that they had, but they never went well, and they did stuff that they knew wasn't good for them, but they did it anyway. Fits right in with a lot of the male detectives that we're familiar with. So I like that there's kind of an equality of poor life choices.
Everybody gets to be broken.
Everybody gets to be broken.
That's funny, the idea of dysfunction. I don't think, you know, that's going to be an ongoing theme in this podcast series. Is right, I forget, is detectives are broken people, and by solving a mystery, they make themselves whole. Maybe, or try to, some of them. They redeem themselves.
They are attracted to and obsessed with something that is missing in their own lives. So they, as we know, they never go home. You know, they stay out and detect all night long. And if they have families, the families are very unhappy with them never taking time off. And to me, I think when I, as a young woman in the 80s reading this stuff, when I first started to really binge read female detective novels, I found that very refreshing and like maybe it's a poor role model, but I liked the idea that it gave me the feeling that, like, yeah, it's cool if you like live in your little, like Kinsey, she has her little apartment that is over like the garage of somebody in her little town of Santa Teresa. And I had a little apartment like that with a circular staircase, same as she did. And another, you know, series, which is sort of silly, but I still like it, Janet Ivanovich, Stephanie Plum novels. Stephanie had a hamster, and that's when I decided to get my first guinea pig and have just like this small animal you could talk to that wouldn't really talk back, and you didn't really have to take care of it too much. So anyway, that's I think that's what's drawn me to that particular era of writers and detectives and in this, you know, under this rubric. Another one that I read extensively when I was in graduate school, I was laid up for like a week in the infirmary with my back had gone out. Like it was the first time I really had back problems. And my fellow students brought me this Amanda Cross novel to read. And I think we were talking last time about how Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco was considered like it was reading that we could do in graduate school for fun. But since it was a professor of semiotics, it was considered, you know, it was respectable for us to be spending time reading that. So Amanda Cross is a professor of is the pen name of a professor of English literature at Columbia, and her protagonist is actually an English professor. So not really fitting into my favorite setup where the detective is an amateur detective. But Kate Fansler, you know, that was another one that was really good to just, you know, read something that was about my life, but not really. And, you know, there were no murders in Princeton in graduate school the whole time I was there.
As you bring these up, being Sue Grafton, maybe more than Amanda Cross, but it's a question for everybody, is I feel like Sue Grafton is not somebody who only women read. And even though she has female protagonists, she doesn't get pigeonholed as, oh, that's somebody. And we've talked, I was talking about this generally, but I think specifically, like, she's a mass market bestseller, and a guy is not going to not have a Sue Grafton book. It's not like it's a, you know, a problem. Do you think that that plays out true? I mean, I don't have a commute, so I don't see people actually on public transit what they're reading.
I really don't know. I mean, I don't know anything about, you know, like whatever demographics they know about the readers. I mean, there must be some men.
Earlier this year, it's almost a year ago now, I think I mentioned last time that, you know, I'd been reading a bunch of novels, either series with male protagonists or that sort of stuff. So like the Jack Reacher novels, the John Connolly, Charlie Parker books, but also the Nero Wolfe I'd been reading recently. And then I started in on the Robert Parker Spencer series. And I think I read the first couple of those and I was like, you know, I'm kind of duded out at the moment. Like, it's not that I had never read books or enjoyed women protagonists, but I actually deliberately said, I need to find more women authors and women protagonists in mysteries. Like, that's what I, you know, I want to supplement the stuff that I already do, not supplement, but, you know, add on and make a deliberate choice. And that was how I actually got into, I read a few other candidates, but the one that really took hold for me this year was Laura Lippman. Her started with the book, her series about Tess Monahan, who's a private investigator in Baltimore. And she is interesting that Jean mentioned kind of the poor life choices thing, because one thing about that series, the Tess Monahan series, is that over the course of it, she goes progressively from making poor life choices to getting into a relationship. And, you know, in the last couple of books, she has a kid. And I remember reading an interview with Lippman who said something like, you know, when the last book came out, that she wasn't sure once Tess had a kid, if she would then, you know, would that basically be the end of the series or not? And so she wrote a book where she basically dived right into that as the setup, where it's a book about motherhood and children, and you know, I kind of vague on remembering what the details were of the plot at this point, but, you know, it was another mother who made that choice. But it was interesting because, as opposed to kind of she's a protagonist who's not really stuck in place. And I haven't read the Sue Grafton novels, and that's actually on my list to pick up, as are like the Sarah Paretsky's as well. But it's one of the really interesting things about that series is kind of she has overt struggles with domesticity and what does she actually want out of life. And, you know, she doesn't want to give up being a private investigator once she's accepted being a private investigator. How does that fit with a committed relationship and getting married? And does she want to get married? Does she want to just be, you know, partners with this man for, you know, indefinitely? And so it's a very interesting series that way. And the other reason I like, because she ages, like the series is about 20 years old, but over the course of it, she's aged about 7 years, I want to say, from kind of her late 20s to the mid 30s, because mm-hmm. she ends the last book talking about potentially having another kid at, you know, the advanced age of 35. So
Yeah. When I was saying that about, you know, the poor life choices and that sort of lone wolf, I was thinking, oh, yeah, but Tess actually manages to settle down. And whether that can, like, be sustained over a series right. will be very interesting, because I don't think anybody else has made that transition from single and very independent to being in having a family. And in a dangerous profession, I think that's part of the reason
right.
the lone wolf thing works, is because you kind of have to be crazy to be doing this job.
Yeah. And there are a couple of books where she overtly has arguments with, you know, her partner or her parents or other people about, you know, should she be doing this job in the first place? Not even before she has a kid. It's like, you know, while we're committed to each other, how can you do this? You know, what is this job? And I like it because, and it's another one of those things where it's like she spends a lot of the series in different books answering different questions that in different years. But is this something that I want to be doing? I mean, tackling, it's not overtly like this is a feminist statement, but they're very overtly feminist issues of what are my obligations to other people? And, you know, should I be doing this job even though it's dangerous? And what does that mean? And that sort of stuff, which I find fascinating. And then getting into things like parenting and all these other issues that Parker is not worried about too much.
Well, I think one of the things about mystery as a category is that it's so broad, right? We talked about in the first episode about what might make one, you know, as a puzzle at the center, let's say. But the fact is, you can find in some genres you can't find people who are like you, whatever that is, young, old, gay, straight, male, female, trans, like all, you know, inclusiveness. Like it's some genres are all guys who are all 45 and grizzled or something, you know, sci-fi, the whole sad puppies, rabid puppies debate with sci-fi. It comes down, you know, we need more dashing heroes. I think we have plenty of those. I think we have plenty of dashing white, straight male heroes. Like that's probably okay. I think there's room for 5%. I think something else, maybe 10 or 50, right? And I think mystery, though, not that mystery is, you know, it's not that it's a magical rainbow land in which everything has been solved, but more like it is much easier to find representation. And I think it's much easier to convince readers to read across representational lines. So readers will read people who are not like themselves, not just women reading male detectives. But, you know, this thing is, I look back and everything I was introduced to and what I was recommended to in school by librarians when I go to bookstores, you know, often run by men, not always, the bookstores that I know best, not just sort of, you know, random ones, the mystery bookstore in Seattle was run by a guy. And, I was often steered to, female authors and female protagonists or both. And, I like that you can find women at every age in novels. So it's not all perky young 25-year-old Halle Bagley or something who's like, yeah, I'm going to solve mysteries. Like, no, that's like, it's not all projected on. There are roles for, and in fact, the fact that it started, you know, was the spinster old maid, you know, late 1890s character, but that evolved into something like, and I want to transition to Katie Lane. Because I noticed you put on your list here, not that you're a spinster. I'm making that sound like, oh, I'm sorry.
It's ancient.
Married woman. You're a married woman. Murder, She Wrote, which is like, I'd love to talk about your love for that show and also whether it's subversive and how subversive it is.
It's subversive if you watch it with my wife, because she has a backstory for Jessica that is just, wow, the woman gets around.
Romantically, or is she the killer in every episode?
She's not the killer. No, if you watch it with Dylan, Jessica just has a lot of romantic interests and a fella in every port. And that's part of what this constant traveling from murder to murder is.
Oh,
she's just, she's actually going to visit various beaux. But I watched Murder, She Wrote when I was young with my mom, and I remember it as the first sort of murder mystery series that I really sunk my teeth into, and loved and thought of as mine, and thought of Jessica as a character that was, you know, how you start thinking of characters not necessarily as friends, but as people that you actually know, because obviously there are some characters that you don't want to be friends with. But Jessica was just, I don't know, she's a She's an independent woman doing her own thing. She's willing to tell you no. She's got writing to do, but she's got this just fascinating and full life. And it sounded like a really, I was a kid when I was watching Murder, She Wrote. So it sounded like a really cool way of being an adult, where you wrote books and you traveled the world and you had all of these interesting friends who did different things. And I recently rewatched most of the series a couple of years ago, and it's still great. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not going to make you think deep thoughts, but it's very entertaining. And I enjoy also betting whether or not it's going to be a laughing Jessica at the end or a judging, shaking her head no Jessica at the end, because those tend to be the two freeze frames.
You know, I heard Laurie R. King, who's we can talk about a bit too, is a great writer and has put out a lot of books, which is also awesome. I heard her speak once, and I felt like she's kind of Jessica Fletcher. Like, she built this career early on. She has an interesting background. She travels a lot. You know, she was married, has children, so she's less unattached than Jessica was. But she's kind of like, and she's really plain spoken and outright and is pretty popular. It's like, oh, well, here's my real life, Jessica Fletcher. For all I know, she's not solved any murders in actual life, but
probably a good thing.
Yeah, you know, Scott McNulty hosts the Random Trek show on this fine Incomparable network. He's been joking about, after he finishes Random Trek, which is one episode of every Star Trek, all series, one episode a week. So when he's done with that, I forget how many years that is, he'll start his Murder, She Wrote recap, and that'll go on for the next, you know, 17 years after that, I think, or something. You can do it in real time. But yeah, so, I mean, you know, I wanted to make sure we talk a lot. We'll be talking a lot about books on this show. But yeah, Jessica Fletcher, as opposed to, say, Columbo, who is kind of this, you know, Columbo as a working man detective. And Jessica Fletcher it was funny. She was slightly more glamorous, but she lived in rural Maine. She was fancy, but not too fancy, right?
Right. Yeah, she's got sweatshirts. She does her own gardening and her own shopping. And, you know, she takes care of herself. They do show bodies, and she's not a rough and tumble detective. It's definitely more on the cozy side, but I liked that they never shied away from the fact that you got to see the dead body.
Tom Bosley was the one of the, there were other co-stars, but he was on the show quite a bit. He was the detective on the show. And, I have a funny, is this Glenning? I don't know if this is Glenning. A friend of his dated Tom Bosley's daughter, went over to the house. The garage was full of Glad trash bags because of truth in advertising laws. We had to use them. They just kept delivering him Glad trash bags. So little known facts.
I thought you were going to say that. There were bodies in those trash bags.
I was going to say, yeah, that's...
Yeah, there might have been.
Oh, that would have been even... That would be creepier. But Shannon, I want to bring you in here because I know we have talked about Nancy Drew last time, and I think Nancy Drew fits. You know, she's a little more of a, or the detective in the series. I think there's a little more sex division there between like Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew. Although I read plenty of Nancy Drews as a kid too. What was your did you cross the line? Were you a Hardy Boy, Nancy Drew, ambidextrous reader, or was Nancy your pick?
It was Nancy almost all the way. I did read a few of the Hardy Boys books. What got me into paying more attention to the Hardy Boys was, of course, my teenage years and Sean Cassidy, and you know, when they did the television show.
Parker Stevenson. Yeah. Don't forget Parker Stevenson.
Pamela Sue Martin as Nancy Drew.
Oh, my God. How did I forget that?
So that's what got me more into paying attention to sort of all of that mini universe of characters. By and large, it was Nancy and her friends Bess and George that really grabbed my attention when I was a young reader, and I stuck with that for the most part.
Do Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys do they cross over in the books ever, or was that just a TV thing?
After the TV show, I think they did some tie-ins, but the original Blue Spine, Yellow Spine books, never the two shall meet. Those two were very, very separate.
Yeah, my 10-year-old daughter loves those books, and I never read either the Hardy Boys or the Nancy Drew, but once she got into them, she devoured, like, you know, it was a Costco box set of the first 12 books, and she inhaled them in about 3 days.
Mm-hmm. It's great that they hold up. I have a topic for a future episode, which is problematic representation of detectives because of historical reasons. we can talk about it. But Nancy, they're not anodyne. They're actually interesting to read still, right? So they hold up over time.
They're also updated. I mean, as I recall, they update the text.
Right.
The puzzles hold up, I think, in general. They're able to keep things interesting enough. But yeah, like you said, language can get updated. Circumstances can get updated. I think some of the original stories were, you know, unthinkingly kind of racist with the way they portrayed African-American characters. And then that gradually got phased out.
Yeah, that's something. There's a lot of interesting things to talk about. And Nera Wolfe, and there's an Aboriginal detective, Australian. We'll come back to that theme. You want to talk a little bit about the writing machine behind it, too. Is it Nancy Drew, like Hardy Boys and some of the other series of the day? They were churned out.
It was a factory.
But also held to a very high standard.
Yeah, by and large. The vast majority of Nancy Drews, and of course I've forgotten her name now, that she wrote under Carolyn Kane. One particular woman wound up writing a huge chunk of the original Nancy Drew run. Just like there was this, I think, one gentleman kind of behind most of the Hardy Boys. So there was a lot of consistency with character portrayals and that sort of thing. Not that that was terribly hard to do since, you know, Nancy and her friends didn't age, perpetually 18.
Mildred Wirt Benson.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think she wrote, right, when she wrote as Carolyn Keene. I mean, there are all these changes in publishing. We don't have to get deep into that, but like the fact that it became cheaper to publish books, and paper was cheaper, mm-hmm. and the whole pulp thing allowed paperback books, and it was an explosion in certain kinds of literature, and genre literature especially, because it used to appear in newspapers as serials, and a lot of the stuff that we read, like Sherlock Holmes, whatever, were in magazines and newspapers, and we think of them as books, but Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew were books. Came out as books, as I mm-hmm. recollect.
They certainly were an attractive price point. I mean, they were just, you know, at the time, you know, $2.99 or whatever it was. That was my allowance, so I could save up, you know, and buy a book a week or a couple books a week. And, you know, my mother, you know, never worried about it.
Could you buy them at a convenience store at your – because I know we're not quite the same age. And I think I recollect going into convenience stores – or drugstores, and I think they sold them like they sold comic books.
They might have. I had a favorite local bookstore when I was young, and so we would always go there and do our book shopping.
I wonder across media here too, and I mean, we're jumping over around places a little bit here in times and eras, but Veronica Mars comes up a lot. I never watched Veronica
she
Mars.
Is,
oh, she's the best, Glenn.
Yeah.
Glenn.
What is this? Every show we're going to find out you
rewatching that series, and I was reminded that I think this is no exaggeration. I think she is my favorite TV character of all time.
Whoa.
And she is so well written, such a great setup. I mean, as a show, my heart belongs a little more to Buffy and Angel and that sort of thing. But Veronica Mars was the transition of the noir influence and that kind of detective to the high school setting worked so well. It was just really well done, especially that first season where you have this great, she's solving a murder, you know, so you've got the fundamental crime. But I was actually thinking about it. And one of the more interesting things is that she's also one of the sub crimes that she's doing is like, is who, well, and one, I mean, one of the
sub crimes. Yeah,
it's like the B plot mystery is somebody raped her at a party. And so, and that's a crime that it's obviously, I think, tricky to make mysteries out of, but it's done really, really well. And actually circles back further in the show. I mean, it comes up a few more times, as a crime, but her combination of she's funny, she's smart, she's, you know, she's got the down on her luck thing. The whole series is about, you know, she was cast out of being, one of the beautiful people, more or less, at the high school, and is now on the fringes and helping her fellow outcasts and all that sort of stuff. It's a great, great series. And I mean, one of the things, she's an amazing character, but one of the best things is that the ensemble of people that she works with are a great team as well.
She has many sidekicks, but her main sidekick is her father, you know?
Yes.
So that's just,
it's a great relationship.
Yes. And he is an actual policeman. I love Veronica Mars, man. That I've only watched it once, but I know I will binge watch it again someday.
It's just made me realize the progression of teenage detectives or quasi-detectives. I mean, Buffy, we've already talked about. That is a mystery show. There's mysteries in the middle of every of it in horror mystery genre. Kim Possible? Any Kim Possible fans?
I've watched a few with my niece.
I love that show. I'm
it's
sorry.
Cute.
I love
it's
that
sweet.
Show.
Yeah.
I talked about it on Unjustly Maligned with Anthony Johnston, also on this network. And then through talking about it, I became friends on Twitter friends with Bob Schooley, who's one of the people who developed Kim Possible. And he's working on something secret now, a new series that he can't talk about. We'll find out about. But I feel Kim Possible was on for, God, I forget how many episodes, 50 or 60 episodes over a few seasons. And it there was Buffy and then there's Kim Possible. And she was wildly, briefly popular in the Disney crowd for probably tweener girls. And then you had Veronica Mars in it's like late 90s, 2002, then 2004. And all cut from a similar cloth, but all dramatically different. In cartoon, sort of cartoony, not noir, but, you know, the vampire thriller, and then this much more – it's kind of hard-boiled, right? Like I said, I've never seen Veronica Mars.
Veronica Mars is very – it's very hard-boiled. Yeah. It's definitely a noir-influenced sort of thing. I mean, the other series that was on at that time, and this is more espionage, is Alias. So another – I mean, not as good to me as Veronica Mars or Buffy, but that same sort of, you know, early 2000s – woman at the heart of it.
It's the teenager thing. It's you're in high school and then in college, and then you're you know, even if you don't want to, you wind up doing this role, or it just falls to you. Isn't Orphan Black? I've not watched Orphan Black.
Oh god, that's good. Awesome too. But
and that is that mystery. That's mystery.
Well, that's a huge sort of that's science fictiony mystery thing. I mean, that's more of that genre of like secret mad science plot that somebody has to unravel. Awesome, you should watch it. But I think it's and I mean that. Actress is amazing. The whole way they do that show is amazing, but I wouldn't call it a mystery.
Again, I keep coming back to this, that it's not, we don't have to struggle to find examples, which is so nice as a genre, and eventually it sort of, you know, subsides, stop thinking about it as much. But I'll circle around back towards the beginning as we started with Miss Marple a bit, and like Holmes, she keeps coming back again and again because there's so many stories, and I can't even think of how many TV series and adaptations there have been of Miss Marple. And so one of my favorite adaptations of Miss Marple, I mean, there's some classic ones, and there are actually some quite good ones. I think there were two almost simultaneously. But Geraldine McEwen, who is a terrific actress and was the Lucia in the Map and Lucia series, which is a lot of – it's a hoot also. She played Miss Marple in – I don't think it was a long run, but it was really beautifully – done. It felt they gave her a little more of a backstory without inventing too much. There was a little more context for her, and she was definitely, I think, I want to say, less baddie than she sometimes portrayed. Like, I don't like seeing Miss Marple portrayed as baddie. I mean, she's disarming, like Father Brown and some of these other humble characters. But does anyone have a favorite a Miss Marple presentation? Have you seen multiple series? Maybe I'm a little too mystery TV obsessed, like PBS.
Yeah, I tend to – I've seen a little bit of the one you're talking about. But yeah, for me, it tends to be the books more than anything else. Just the fact that, you know, Agatha Christie, you know, like some of the authors before her like that you mentioned, you know, was able to take the characteristics of, you know, an elderly woman who – it's not necessarily that she's nosy, but she pays attention. And she's watching everything, and she's drawing conclusions, and – for Agatha Christie to sort of take those characteristics and turn them into the biggest strengths of Ms. Marple's detective, where you've got, on the other hand, Hercule Poirot and his psychology, and he, you know, talks about the science of it. Ms. Marple just does it. She doesn't care what it's called. You know, she just knows it works. And, you know, I love those things about the mysteries that feature her.
Things just tick away for her, and she accumulates details, and people don't take her seriously, and then she unloads.
Exactly. I've been watching the Geraldine McEwen ones because I wanted to be a little bit more up on Miss Marple, and they are there. What I like about it is that, like you say, she's disarming. I was surprised how, you know, much respect though that people had for her abilities, like that. They weren't treating her as like, oh, the ditzy old lady, you know, she somehow came up with the answer. Like the people who knew her really, really respected her, including detectives.
That was the key in the books as well. Like, you know, the people who meet her the first time almost inevitably scoff, you know, what's this old lady going to know? And, you know, then she proves herself, she comes up with the right answer, and then she develops the relationships with these people who realize that they can trust her, that she is going to see and make her parallels and be right most of the time. Yeah, it's actually got to the point with me reading them a few times that if Miss Marple knew something more detective-y, like the presence of disappearing ink or some chemical that could have caused whatever it was, that would actually throw me out of the story slightly, because it's like, it's not that, you know, she's lived a long life. Yeah, she might have picked up knowledge here and there, but when she uses more formal detective methods once in a while, it almost feels wrong.
Well, this gets us into, you know, I was trying to think if there's anything that's unique about women as protagonists, whether written by men or women. And I realize there is that. It's not that, I mean, you have detectives who fool people, like Hercule Poirot. He's so foreign. He's so Belgian, apparently, to the English. Oh, my goodness. He's Belgian. Oh, cosmopolitan. That they just assume he's ditzy, or the way he thinks is just not, you know, it's not very English, so it can't be very good or something like that. And he slowly just works away, grinds and grinds and grinds, and comes to the truth. And, female detectives can use, it's not a, you know, womanly wiles thing. It's more like they're underestimated. And you're right. Miss Marple gets taken seriously, but other detectives, female detectives, are often shunted aside or ignored. Nero Wolfe, Rex Stout wrote, I forgot the character's name. He wrote a few, entries. And I think Rex Stout was a very good self-critic. And I think he decided he could not actually produce convincing a female protagonist. So he only wrote one or two, because if he did a series, he was about the money, about everything else. He would have written 60 novels about her. But she appears in some of the Nero Wolfe ones, and she takes no guff. Everybody else gives her some space. She occupies a space in that room. But I also think you've got the Miss Marples, like, oh, now we have to take her. Oh my goodness. You know, what is the mind behind their, you know, attitude?
Trying to figure out, it seems like there's these different classes or subgenres that I'm thinking about. And it just, some of it I think is tied a bit to genre, how they get portrayed. A couple of things that occurred to me as we started were the other female protagonist detectives. One of them is in DC Comics, in the Batman universe, Renee Montoya, the detective. Yeah. Who winds up becoming the Question, that superhero. And, you know, she, you know, there's a little bit of she's the woman maybe among her peers, but by and large, you know, she is accepted as she is, and she gets things done. Similarly, with the Disney animated series Gargoyles from back in the 90s.
I loved that show.
That featured another woman as the detective and the main conduit between the gargoyles and the new modern world, Elisa Raza. And, you know, she was another one that stood her ground. And, you know, if anybody actually dared to, you know, say something about her being a woman, she, you know, immediately cut them off. And that worked very well. And then on the other hand, you know, as we've been talking about the cozy mystery thing, I haven't read very many of them, but they seem to be everywhere in the bookstores. This whole subgenre of the female protagonist, she's not a detective, she's mm-hmm. a baker, or she runs an embroidery shop, or she runs a coffee house, or she's an interior decorator. And it seems like the sole purpose of these novel series is how many more puns can they make from the titles?
Yes.
It drives me nuts.
I hate that.
Turns me off. I don't want to read something like that. And that's my image of the cozy mystery that drives me nuts, that you've got this woman that, you know, she just, I'm assuming, happens to put together, you know, the clues, but based on, you know, her expertise rather than actual detective work.
I gotta interject here. My friend Ayelet Waldman wrote the mystery series, the Mommy Track Mysteries, which are exactly this problem. They're really good. Her detective is she was a prosecuting or a defense attorney and took time off to raise children. And the husband is, you know, as a writer, as in real life. And but it's nursery crimes, the big nap, death gets a timeout, the cradle robbers.
Ow.
She has moved on. She wrote seven of these. They did very good mid-list, upper mid-list thing. And then she moved on to really searing, difficult, interesting things that destroy your heart. They're so good. So she left that genre, but it was a great genre for her. And she was writing them actually while she was raising children. So that was, it was like this, a little bit of snaking in the tail thing. But yeah, it's funny how, right, there is that genre that you have to make the puns. Like the puns apparently are what you do to stand out and get attention. I don't know.
The first point is the title, and then, okay, how do I write a story that
exactly,
you know, that makes this title? And, you know, on the other hand,
those rabbi books started it all. Yeah. If he hadn't done that.
Yeah. And I was just trying to think on the other extreme of some other things that I've read. is occasionally the female protagonist who's too capable. And like the biggest one that leaps out at me, Peter Tremaine has written a historical mystery series that features this, I forget, 12th, 13th century, I forget how many centuries ago, Druid priestess or nun now, I'm sorry, but she's engaged, she's educated. She has gone to their equivalent of law school. She is just so supremely capable that it's almost a turnoff to read those as well. It's like, you know, there needs to be balance. You know, there needs to be, not that they're just bumbling their way into things, but neither should they be so capable that they're almost unbelievable.
Oh yeah, you don't want Superman, when Superman became essentially God in the DC universe, mm-hmm. like it's not very exciting when you have Godman who can just kind of do anything. You need to have some mystery, and it can't just be kept from us, you know, it can't just be something we don't know.
Right.
It has to be something that they actually have some blind spot or incapability. Yeah, you know, I was also thinking, you had brought up this as a topic, and I thought we should talk about is the husband and wife teams, which there are so many. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, you know, the Thin Man, of course, is a great movie example of that genre. Even there's the Thrilling Adventure Hour podcast, which is now sort of over.
Yes.
They had that great parody of it. So it was beyond belief with
Frank and Sadie Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a parody. Instead of being drinking, sometimes they essentially are constantly drinking. Anyway, it was very, very funny.
Yes, but it's
a wonderful
so
modern
civilized. Yes.
But yeah, Shannon, you'd assembled a short list of these sort of wives, you know, wives, partners, male, female teams. I thought that's an interesting subgenre.
Yeah,
subgenre.
Because when I was thinking about, you know, who I read and what I read, and I was surprised, you know, I know of a great many female protagonists, but I haven't necessarily read that as many of them as I thought. And when I was thinking of, you know, the books that I do read a lot of that have female protagonists, usually there's a partnership of some sort, whether it's the Anne Perry books. She's got like two different historical series, the Thomas and Charlotte Pitt novels, where, you know, they get married like right after the first book. And then as a husband and wife, he's the policeman. He grew up poor. She's upper middle class, almost gentry, and she can, you know, enter into those. So they complement one another really well. And I think that's the key. Another example that we talked a whole lot about last time, Peter Wimsey and Harriet Vane.
Oh, yes.
The fact that they both bring different things to the table and complement each other really well. And of course, one of the Agatha Christie's, it wasn't the very first one I read, but it was one of the ones that made me think, I want to keep reading this author. Was The Secret Adversary that featured Tommy and Tuppence Beresford just before they got married. Yeah.
Wow, that's so long. Which is that one of her early
What's
ones?
What's one of her very, very early ones?
1922, I see. Yeah, that's right. I may have read that once a long time ago. I forgot that existed. Oh, you know what? It's in the public domain. You can get it at Project Gutenberg because it was published in 1922. Nice. It's in the United States. 1 year off the... There's going to be a lot of interesting... We're going to rediscover a lot of works. I have an idea for a book about this. In fact, starting in 2019, January 1st, 2019... Everything in the public domain, everything from 1923 that was published goes in the public domain. This goes on for years and years, year after year mm-hmm. after year, until you hit a different point in the copyright regime where it's author's death plus 75 years or
70
years rather. 70, yeah. And so so there's going to be this really interesting thing where we rediscover a lot of stuff because it'll suddenly be pushed out. And I bet mysteries are going to be part of it because that was a really great time. And a lot of that stuff is lost because no one knows who has the copyright, if it's cleared, whatever. So you don't get movies, you don't get things written about it. You know, an example I want to mention, this a little bit off to the side, is, you know, I already mentioned Laurie King, by the way, like Mary Russell. Those books are Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes, and they are equal partners. She is as smart as he is. She starts as a teenager and grows to a woman, and they get married. Spoilers, it's from 10 years, 10 years ago. But they're equal partners. But the one I want to bring up is a very odd one, which is Dick Francis, who wrote almost exclusively male protagonists and wrote mostly jockeys. And I think I read – at one point I never reread him, but I think I may have read everything he wrote. When his wife died, he said, you know, I always felt bad. She should have had her name on the cover, his wife Mary. And he said, and originally she was thought of as the researcher. And he really said they co-developed and wrote these books together. And he said, you know, she had a brother – I looked this up. She had a brother named Dick, so she always called me Richard. So Dick Francis for me was a pseudonym for Mary and Richard together. And I thought, how sweet that he didn't say that when she was alive. But he never. He said, I'll never write again, and he didn't. He lived 10 more years, and he never wrote another book because he lost his collaborator. And so that's an interesting thing. And suddenly, like, do you read a book when you say, I didn't know this was a collaboration. I thought this is a guy writing about jockeys. And it's, does it give you a different tent? I don't know. I haven't reread.
Yeah, I did reread a lot of Dick Francis when I binged on him. I would read a lot. I would go back and reread my favorites. And yeah, like you, when it came out that, you know, it was his wife, and I'm just like, okay, that makes sense. Because mm-hmm. there were a lot of character development issues. Like you said, women were all, I can't think of a single book by him where the woman was actually the lead character. It was always a guy, but there were often women right kind of like one step behind that, you know,
well
were the romantic
too.
The romantic interest or the mentor figure. And yeah, but always the female characters were very well rounded. As much so as the men.
Katie, I want to circle around to you because you mentioned Denise Mina, or Mina, and I'd never heard her name before today. I am so uneducated. Like, I feel like I've read 1,000 mysteries in my life, maybe more, and there are 20,000 I haven't read. And I just saw her name earlier today. I see you mentioned her. She's got multiple series that you're interested in that she's written. Can you tell me something about her?
She is a fantastic Scottish writer. So she writes what the subgenre is called tartan noir. And she's she's got three series. She writes broken people so well. Oh my gosh. And she always has a female protagonist. The first one, the Garnet Hill Trilogy, is is dark. It is probably the grittiest of the three different series that she has. And the lead character is constantly in this state of drinking or getting sober, dealing with rehab. Like, she's just gotten out of a mental institution for some really big break. And all of a sudden her boyfriend or fiance, I can't remember who, like she, a night of partying, she wakes up and he is dead on the floor with his throat slit.
God.
Right?
Holy cow.
And the people that she has helping her as she's going through figuring out, you know, who done it, is her best friend, who is just an enabler. With a capital E, and her brother, who's a drug dealer. So none of these people are the people that you want to be, but she writes so empathetically that you understand these characters. They might, you know, they might not make the choices you would make, but you understand them and you want to see what their development is. The series that she's writing right now, that she's got a new book coming out in a month or two, it follows this detective, Alex Moreau. It's a Glasgow detective. And we were talking earlier about women who, over the course of the series, they get into a relationship or have kids and they start to re-examine their choices. And that's where Alex is right now. But she's not actually re-examining anything. She's doubling down on bad ideas. And she's being forced to look at whether or not, can she change? Is the relationship interesting enough for her to change? So she's a great detective, not a really good person.
Oh my gosh.
I've read those. They are intense. Like, you cannot put them down.
I was going to say this sounded up your alley, Jean, if you hadn't read them.
I have Scottish. All right. Tartan noir is a new term to me, and I'm totally going to remember that.
This reminds me of Helen Mirren in Prime Suspect, too. I only remember watching the first season of their series of that, and I don't remember. She was difficult. She had a complicated private life. She was having an affair with one of her subordinates, and she's kind of along those lines, too, like bad decision theater.
Yes, she is bad. Bad decision theater. But now the Denise Mina, at least I've read the Garnet Hill trilogy. I don't know if I've read any of the other ones, but that protagonist is a mess. I mean, she's not, I mean, Helen Mirren as, you know, the detective in Prime Suspect is like way pulled together and very successful compared to that character is a mess.
This reminds me of, I want to bring up Miss Fisher before we get towards the end here.
Excuse me, Glenn. We'll do a rapid. It's Miss Fisher.
Miss Fisher. Miss Fisher. Friney. It took us, my wife and I spent like We are rewinding until we found the closed caption thing on the recording we were doing. We're like, what is her name? What is her name? They're calling her, what are they, Franny? Froony? What? Fry? It's like, Franny, of course. Goddess name, of course. Right. She's called Franny. But Miss Fisher's, so I haven't read the books yet. I mentioned this previously. I haven't read the books yet. I'm looking forward to those. We're not quite through the first season, but one of the things I like about Miss Fisher is the way she's portrayed in the series is she is unapologetically exactly who she is. She does stuff that guys do all the time, and women are not typically allowed to be depicted doing them, and she just does them, and she rolls with it, and she doesn't, blood doesn't frighten her, and she's sleeping with people, and it's all her initiative. And you're like, she's so, like, both, like, hard-edged, but also comes through and makes the right, you know, moral call for the truth and justice morals as opposed to morality. And we're joking, you know, by the time we're not even, I think we're episode 10 or 11 of the first season, her house is full of people. Like, we're like, by season two, she's going to have like 50 strays she's collected and is nurturing back to health in some form. She's got Jane and she's got Mr. Butler and whatever. But I love her because such a breath of fresh air in a genre that's usually so grim. She is having fun. And I don't know, were there other Miss Fisher's fans either written or televised here?
I love the television series. It's one of my favorite things to watch. And one of the reasons that I like it so much is exactly what you're saying. Like, she is not bad decision theater, but she's also not that typical, sort of buttoned up female character. She's much more like a male protagonist, but maybe one who, isn't hard drinking and making poor decisions all the time. She's more fun for me to watch than some others.
Has anybody read the novels? I'm looking forward to reading them.
Not yet. No?
I think the TV show has come gradually here. It's hard. You can't get the DVDs right now or something. I was looking because airing season 3.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to spend a fortune if you actually want to buy it. So we're recording it off PBS. We have an over-the-air, the craziest Rube Goldberg-y thing that lets us record over-the-air. We have an actual antenna. We have an antenna on our house. An antenna. And I have a digital recorder attached to it. And I record, mostly record Miss Fisher's. And
it's also on the Jeopardy Netflix.
Is it?
Yes.
No.
Gotta watch that.
Yeah, no.
I thought it wasn't.
3 seasons.
Well, good news. Oh, it wasn't. The last time I could not find it. Well, this is great. This is great. Maybe we overlooked it. So, I'm a big fan, and we'll talk. I'm sure we'll devote an episode to her at some point because we'll all watch some and talk about that. So let's do a rapid fire round to close down. Incomparable proper, flagship show, the Incomparable, the flagship being a Zeppelin, of course. That's the kind of ship it is. We often do drafts, and this is not a draft. We're not pitting one detective. Who could Franny Fisher take? Could she take Clarice Starling? Well, it would be an interesting fight. But let's talk about quickly other protagonists or writers we didn't mention. Let's just here. I'll go around. I'll start with Jean. Who haven't we mentioned you'd like to discuss?
We barely mentioned, but V.I. Warshawski, Sarah Paretsky. That's an awesome series set in Chicago, and she's one of my favorite characters. If you're looking for awesome women protagonists to read, I highly recommend Sarah Paretsky.
I have to check that out because I saw that movie when it came out, and I have just the vaguest memories. And I know it was
it was horrible.
Yeah.
Let's face it. Like, they haven't really hit any of these. Like, there was one with Stephanie Plum as well.
Catherine Heigl.
Catherine Heigl, and yes, beautiful actress. Oh well, it was Kathleen Turner was V.I. Warshawski. She would be great as that, but it just didn't work, and the books are just way better. So,
Katie, I know you got a couple things on your list that we didn't talk about.
There's a female protagonist, but is in a totally different medium. Is the Gone Home video game, where you are the main character. You are a young woman who has come home to an empty house on a dark and stormy night, and none of your family is there, and you have to figure out why. What happened over this last year that you have been away studying abroad? And you go through the house and collect clues and examine different things. And one of the things that I like so much about it that's rare for video games is, one, it's a mystery, but two, you are a female protagonist. So everybody who plays is playing a young woman, and a young woman in the 1990s, which I am partial to because I was. So that would be my recommendation outside of books and television.
And, of course, made in Portland, Oregon.
Indeed.
Indeed. Of course it was. James, what have we skipped over as
we... Oh, well, so many things that we've skipped over. Not just me. No. one I would mention is anybody who liked Veronica Mars, especially if you also liked Buffy, is that Rob Thomas, who created Veronica Mars, has a show on now called iZombie.
Yes.
With Liv Moore as the main character. And it is a detective... a mystery slash, I don't know, it's not really horror, fantasy, whatever. But zombies are real. And the main character is, in fact, a zombie. But if you like Veronica Mars, it's very much of a the same creator sensibility. So she solves crimes in part by eating brains and having the memories of the people who were killed, which is a great conceit. One series that I love and recommend to everybody, because it's not a well-known series, but Nicola Griffith, who is now much, in my circles at least, much more famous for writing Hild, mm-hmm. which I have not yet read. Oh, yeah. But she wrote a series of books about a character called Odd Torvingen, who is a woman who is a Norwegian ambassador's daughter and policeman. But she's this 6-foot-tall, hyper-competent lesbian badass, basically. I don't even remember what her actual job is. She teaches self-defense, but they're very, very noir. It starts with a book called The Blue Place, where she runs into a woman and this woman's place blows up and they fall in love and have to solve who is after her new love interest. And it's a fantastic trilogy. And the last book actually ends up in Seattle, so very nice. You mentioned briefly, but Clarice Starling in Silence of the Lambs, I think, is she's a great character. I particularly like with those. I like Silence of the Lambs, the movie, better than the book, personally. And while I enjoy the book Hannibal, which also has Clarice Starling in it, it's not an amazing portrayal of her as a character as much as the Silence of the Lambs book, but she's obviously a great detective, and Jodie Foster, a great performance from her.
Thank you. And Shannon, anything we skipped over?
We touched on most of the things that I've been talking of, that I've been reading or I've devoted a lot of time to. I thought of one series that I want to read when I was poking around and looking. I've seen these on my mother-in-law's shelf, and it made me think of something that we can talk about on a later podcast. We've talked about how gender representation is pretty strong and equal in mysteries. I'm not sure racial representation is the same thing, because the thing that leaped out at me was Alexandra McCall Smith, the number one ladies detective agency, with Precious Ramatswe as the protagonist. I have yet to read those, but I want to.
Those are lovely.
Yes.
He's weirdly good at the whole thing of writing a woman detective and an African. I mean, I'd love to have somebody who's actually, you know, from Botswana
to verify.
Critique.
Yeah.
But I mean, I've lived in Ghana and there were so many little things that I was like, that's right on the money.
Okay. Good to know.
What about, well, if we do that, we got to throw in Walter Mosley.
Yes.
Yes. President Clinton's favorite writer. That's how he came to my attention.
There's a book that I love that has a black female protagonist. It's not, it's Colson Whitehead's The Intuitionist, which is a mystery. And it's sort of not a mystery. It's not presented as genre fiction, I think. It's supposed to be literature. I'll pull an Ursula K. Le Guin on that one. The Intuitionist is a fascinating book, and it is full of representational positions you don't usually see. You see it more in mainstream literature, I think, these days, but you don't see it in the genre. The one other detective I'll mention very briefly is Nao Marsh. I had to look up the pronunciation. I found a site in which it explained it. It's N-G-A-I-O, Marsh. It's an early New Zealand writer, and she wrote, I believe, mostly male detectives, but she's up there kind of like a little bit post-Christie, and had a wonderful series of books, including the one with a wonderful title, A Surfeit of Lampreys. The family's all lamprey. Just, oh, the titles are so good. They're not puns. They're just rich and wonderful. Well, I think we have put a good hour into this topic, and we will certainly and delightfully be addressing it in parts again. But I thought it'd be good to talk up front as we get into this show about this. And so let me just thank everyone for their participation, all the panelists on this episode. Jean McDonald, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. It was awesome.
A pleasure, Shannon Sudderth. I know you'll be back with more mysterious
equally
things to discuss.
Having a great time.
James Callan, now that you've moved to an undisclosed location, I'm still looking forward to talking to you by this telephonic device. Thanks for being on.
Oh, thank you so much.
And Katie Lane, keep watching Miss Marple. I'm sorry, keep watching. Who is it? Jessica Fletcher. I don't know who it is. But thanks for being on the episode.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We're all Miss Marple. She became a meme again recently because of the VR episode. I recommend everyone look up Jessica Fletcher virtual reality because it's I watched a little bit of it. I don't remember why this came up. It was all over Twitter. And it's a more accurate depiction of virtual reality than most modern depictions of virtual reality. And that is Afoot, episode 2. Thank you all for joining us. We'll be back soon with an episode about radio mysteries with some special panelists to talk about that. So tune in, find us at theincomparable.com/afoot, and you can subscribe to us on Twitter and send us email at afoot@afootcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.